The Takeaway is supported by the Netflix original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Following a high-stakes legal battle over a celebrity sex tape, this documentary explores the shadowed world of billionaires undermining democracy, now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, June 28th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And we begin this hour in Texas, in a courtroom battle that's now on the front lines of the national debate over illegal immigration. Civil rights groups in Texas, along with cities and counties, are challenging SB 4 in the U.S. District Court in San Antonio. The law is an effective ban on sanctuary cities. These are jurisdictions that refuse to use local law enforcement to enforce federal immigration laws. Here's the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, at the signing of SB 4 back in May.
This law cracks down on policies like the Travis County Sheriff, who declared that she would not detain known criminals accused of violent crimes. Those policies are sanctuary city policies and won't be tolerated in Texas.
Now, SB 4 divided the Texas legislature before it passed back in May. The law requires local police to enforce federal requests to detain undocumented immigrants. It also allows local cops to ask people about their immigration status in routine stops. In addition, and this is part of the controversy too, officials who don't cooperate with these policies or even criticize them could face charges themselves. The law is set to go into effect on September 1st, but it's up to U.S. District Court Orlando Garcia now. Steve Laddick is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law and co-editor of Just Security. He joins me now from Austin. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be with you.
And it's good to have you. I described SB 4 a little bit, but let's talk about a routine traffic stop in Texas now under SB 4. Broken taillight. Cop walks up to the car. What happens?
Yeah, so, you know, typically the police officer would ask the driver for their license and registration. They're now allowed to ask, obviously, if the driver has lawful immigration status. But more importantly, Todd, when they go back to their car to run the license and registration to do their check, you know, presumably they're now also going to be checking their database to see if they can determine and ascertain the immigration status of the driver and other individuals who are stopped. And then at that point, the question becomes whether if it's someone who's undocumented, there's what's called a detainer. That is to say, a notice from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that any law enforcement officer who comes upon this person should hold them, should detain them on behalf of the federal government. If that flag triggers, SB 4 requires that officer to exercise the detainer to take that person into custody.
So there are lots of different perspectives here. Civil rights groups are suing against this law. Latino groups might have one perspective, but also cities and municipalities. From the cops' perspective in this case, is it basically, look, we're local cops, we're not federal officials, this is a drain on resources and not our job?
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I think we have to be very careful, Todd, to draw a distinction between circumstances where local jurisdictions want to cooperate with federal law enforcement and choose to expend their resources to assist, immigration authorities, federal law enforcement authorities, versus situations like under SB 4, where by dint of a state law, these local officials are now being compelled to do so. Todd, really, no matter what, even if their, you know, time and energy is better directed elsewhere, even if they don't have the manpower or the wherewithal to prioritize immigration enforcement over, say, domestic violence calls, over, say, you know, other kinds of more serious and violent crimes. And so I think the concern here is really threefold. First, that it's going to ramp up, you know, a kind of profiling where local officers are actually on the lookout for folks who they, quote, suspect, unquote, are out of status. Second, it's going to take them away from things that they very well might think are more important to protecting the safety of their communities. And third, and perhaps most importantly, it takes away their ability even to criticize, even to oppose what they're doing while they're doing it, right? That is to say, it interferes with their right to speak out against the very policy they are being commandeered into enforcing.
And that might be a First Amendment issue. What about that part of the law where officials who say, go to a microphone or tell a reporter, I think this is bad policy, could face sanctions or even charges? Is that usual? Is that an uncommon thing?
I mean, I think it's worth saying, Todd, you know, SB4, there's very little about SB4 that is usual. But I think that the speech restrictions, although not necessarily the most, you know, onerous from the perspective of those communities who are at risk and who are most likely to be impacted by SB4, the speech restrictions may be the lowest hanging fruit from a constitutional law perspective, because there's no reason why a local sheriff couldn't simultaneously exercise his or her duty while registering his or her protest. I mean, I think that's the, you know, the speech here would not actually get in the way of carrying out the policy. And so I think, you know, courts are probably not going to have too much trouble at least getting rid of the speech restrictions. I think the much bigger and more troubling question is what courts are going to do with the compelled activity rules in SB4.
So there's that First Amendment aspect. There's probably a Fourth Amendment issue here of unreasonable search, and certainly many of the civil rights groups involved here are concerned about that. Steve Laddick, this is clearly an issue that extends beyond Texas. This is about SB4, but there are many jurisdictions around the country that are branded sanctuary cities, many lawsuits ongoing. So how does this extend beyond the borders of Texas?
Well, I think, you know, Todd, we're seeing a progression. I mean, we saw California take a shot with Prop 187. We saw Arizona take a shot with SB 1070. You know, SB 4 is just the latest in this escalating series of measures where states are trying to basically deputize their own officers into federal immigration enforcement, Todd, largely because they disagree with how vigorously or not the federal government is doing its own job. And so I think what happens in San Antonio in the SB 4 litigation is going to have reverberations far outside of Texas, as other states increasingly decide how much of the mantle of federal immigration policy they really want to take up, even when the federal government lacks either the wherewithal or the institutional interest in enforcing it to the full letter of the law.
Well, this case is in Texas. Certainly, appeals are likely after the U.S. District Court rules in the challenge to SB4, the sanctuary cities law that was enacted in May in Texas. Steve Laddick, professor at the University of Texas School of Law from Austin. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
No excuses for human rights abuses. No excuses for human rights abuses. No excuses.
You're hearing their protesters on Monday night gathered outside the Hudson County Correctional Facility in New Jersey. That crowd was gathered to voice their anger about the death of Rolando Meza Espinoza. Espinoza was an undocumented immigrant who was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and held since April. He died in custody after being transferred to a hospital from the Hudson County facility. Espinoza was a Honduran national who apparently had a range of health problems, including cirrhosis of the liver, diabetes, and anemia. But his family's lawyers say he was not given the medications he asked for and needed. The death once again raises questions about conditions in facilities where undocumented immigrants like Espinoza are held after they're picked up. Rolando Espinoza was the 10th person to die in ICE custody since October. The Takeaway reached out to ICE and to the Hudson County Correctional Facility, but neither responded to us. Betsy Plum is vice president of policy at the New York Immigration Coalition, and she's been following the case.
What we've been told by the federal government, by the Hudson County Detention Center, is that Rolando died from complications from an existing medical condition. But what we've been told by his family, by his family's lawyer, is that he wasn't receiving the proper medication for the medical conditions that he had. And so, of course, if an individual is suffering from cirrhosis, from anemia, from diabetes, and they're not being properly medicated, not having the proper medical attention that they require, of course they're going to die. And this is a real pulse point, I think, on the conditions of our immigration detention system.
What has Immigration and Customs or the Hudson County Correctional Facility said about Mr. Espinoza's detention and his death?
I think, unfortunately, they've said very little. And I think the best example of that is that the family of this individual didn't even know that he had passed away, that he had died for multiple days until they called to check in on him. So I think that's the first point. There's also been garbled information that's come out from Immigration and from the detention center since. They first notified around the death and their sort of reporting using a different name. And then when they finally didn't need to say something, they said, well, it was gastrointestinal bleeding and it was because of a prior and pre-existing medical condition. So I think we have not learned enough about, was he being treated for the medical conditions that he had? How was he being treated? Why did it take him so long to actually get to a proper medical center?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit confusing, Betsy Plum. Even if his medical condition was pre-existing, even if he had it before he was taken into detention, whether the condition was pre-existing or not is almost irrelevant.
It's absolutely irrelevant. And I think this type of treatment of individuals that are in our jails, are in detention centers, and I do want to note that Rolando was not being held for any criminal charge or any criminal reason. He was held simply because he was an undocumented immigrant who was picked up by immigration. But how we treat anyone in these settings, I think, is one of the greatest marks of who we are as a society. And I think you look at some of the most what we would call depraved societies across the globe, and we're no better than them if we allow individuals to die in jails.
Well, as we step back from this particular case, Betsy Plum, 10 detainees have died in ICE custody since October of last year. Is that figure correct? And is that number raising alarms?
I think, yes, that's the same number we have. And absolutely, one death would raise alarms. But I think what we're seeing, and this is unfortunately not a new trend, that our immigration detention centers do not meet the mark. And I think this is also, again, we're at the intersection of a complicated place, and we're seeing in real time not only the impact of President Trump's war on immigrants, but really for-profit prison system that more than anything is really benefiting off of immigration enforcement.
Well, Betsy, this jail, the Hudson County Correctional Facility where Rolando Espinoza was detained, it's part of a controversial program called 287G. What is that?
So 287G agreements basically allow for local law enforcement, like a county sheriff's deputy or a local police officer, to be deputized and to act as a federal immigration agent. And over the years, these agreements have really been proven to be expensive, to be ineffective in actually targeting the individuals who may pose a safety risk, and incredibly damaging for that reason, because they just have a big dragnet to community police relations. The problem we have right now is that despite the compounding evidence that 287G agreements are bad policy, President Trump and the Department of Homeland Security have directed as many municipalities as possible to enter into these agreements. And I think an immediate consequence of that is that we will see a dramatic increase in the number of immigrants that are arrested and are then detained. This is a vehicle, again, not for public safety, but to criminalize immigrants and separate families, and to put individuals in the exact position that Rolando was put into. He was arrested and detained and put into a jail that has a bed contract with the federal government, so they're getting $100 a night to hold immigrants. Again, there are so many intersecting points here that really show the inhumanity and the cruelty of this system.
Betsy Plum, Vice President of Policy at the New York Immigration Coalition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Student loan debt. 44 million Americans have it. Politicians talk about it, but many who carry that debt carry it as a secret.
My own husband, he has no idea.
I have blatantly lied to my friends about student loans.
I carry guilt, but mostly embarrassment.
In so many ways, I felt embarrassed.
I feel like a big fat friggin' loser.
Americans hold more than $1.3 trillion in student loan debt now, according to the New York Federal Reserve. That's far more than even the nation's credit card debt. The average American with student debt now owes $37,000 at a time when the average annual wage in this country is just $50,000. Anna Sale is the host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC Studios, and she wanted to hear more than just numbers. She called out for people's stories, and they responded, from a veterinarian with over $500,000 in debt to an immigrant who's paying off his loans but admits he regrets his decision to go to school.
Well, it's certainly a rite of passage, but it's a rite of passage for more and more people. People are taking out more student debt, more people are taking out the loans, and they're paying them back at a slower rate. So this is a new reality. We're hitting record numbers of student debt year after year. And why we wanted to do this episode was because there's been a lot of big picture economic reports about how that's affecting the economy, how it's affecting the pace at which young people can do things like buy their first homes. But we wanted to hear from individual people about how it was making them feel about their education, whether they thought it was worth it, and what it meant for the economic choices they were making in their own lives at the most sort of minute level.
So people can go on the Death, Sex, and Money website. There are thousands of stories and some interactive tools there that are really interesting. You talk to a lot of individual people. Who's Alyssa?
Alyssa is a veterinarian in Pennsylvania. And what struck me about her is she has no regrets about taking out the student debt that she has, but she had one of the largest amounts that we heard. Alyssa owes more than $500,000 for her veterinary education, but she feels shame complaining about it. Let's listen to her talk about that.
I earn like more than 90-some% of people in this country, and here I am going, oh my gosh, but I'll never retire, or, you know, I'll never be able to buy a home, and who am I to think that having a fulfilling career is that important?
So you hear her there saying that she feels awkward complaining about having this enormous student debt, but then she also, every decision she makes, every spending decision she makes, she thinks about this debt. She talked about buying a dish rack that she felt guilty about because she thought it might be too expensive, because any money she spends, she could be spending to pay down this debt.
So what does that decision then mean for someone like Alyssa? Clearly taking on a lot of student debt is supposed to be a gateway to a life where she doesn't have to worry about the purchase of every dish rack, right? And yet that's where she is.
You know, that's something we heard from a lot of listeners when we asked this question, that part of what was so difficult about dealing with their student loan debt is, by all appearances, they're educated. They maybe have a good job. It looks like they're succeeding and achieving that American dream of middle-class success. I talked to a guy named Sharif who immigrated from Bangladesh. He put himself through school, became a chemical engineer, but now, because of his student loan payments, which no one he works with knows about how much they are, he regrets it. He says he might have been better off economically if he'd never gone to school. Let's listen to this.
Before I went to college, right, I was working for a hotel. I was making like around $3,000 a month. And that was a very good living at that time. Versus going through school, getting a job, I don't know what to call it, let's say prestigious job. My situation, my financial situation hasn't really improved. Even my lifestyle hasn't really improved that much. So when I compare the two, it almost seems like if I hadn't gone to college, I probably would have been better off.
Has the economy changed out from under people like Alyssa and Sharif and the other people you talk to? Are wages not high enough so that now they can catch up with those student loan payments?
Well, you hear a lot of things. I mean, the one thing I hear a lot is these are decisions that people make when they're 18 and 19 and 20 years old. So they don't quite know what they want to do with their lives. They maybe Google what their future earnings might be. Some people will say, look, I thought I was going to make more money than I really am, and now I regret this decision. So they're making decisions with kind of partial information, but there's also a lot of cultural pressure to, you know, you finish high school, what do? You go to college, you figure out how to go to college. The financial aid office says to pay for your college, sign these documents, and we'll give you these loans. And to get a full picture of what that's going to mean for your monthly payment, a lot of students I talked to just didn't have that sense. And then they graduate, the next month they get their first student loan payment, and they're shocked. And so there's a failure, you know, at a lot of levels, at the individual level, to understand the consequences of taking out these loans. But it also doesn't seem like we have anyone at any part of the system saying, guys, just so you understand, this is what this is going to mean. If you take out this loan now when you're 18, this is what it's going to mean for your life when you're 25, 26, 30, 35.
I think for me, Anna, listening to these stories and the interviews that you've done, it just really brings into stark relief the idea of confinement versus freedom. You know, people in maybe tighter economic circumstances trying to find a way up the ladder in this country, in many ways to find themselves still confined.
It's a very common experience, and it's an increasingly common experience in our country. And I think that's why we were so interested to do this project, because we know student debt in this country is going up, But there's not a lot of conversation about people saying, hey, this is my student loan payment every month. This is what I have to do to make this payment. So we wanted to pull that back a little bit and say, are you frustrated with your student loans? Tell us why. Tell us also, if you feel like you've gotten a handle on them, how you're dealing with it, share those stories. And so that's all what we're collecting on our website now. More than 1,000 people have shared their stories about their student loans and all the mixed feelings that come with them.
Anna Sale is the host of Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. Anna Sale, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This episode of Death, Sex, and Money on student loan debt is available today in your podcast feed. And visit deathsexmoney.org/student loans for an interactive tool of over 1,000 stories collected by Anna Sale and her colleagues.
This is Brian from Austin, Texas. I've got over $70,000 in educational loan debt, and I do not have a career in the field I wanted to go into, and it was in aviation to be a professional pilot. I now work as a maintenance tech making about $55,000 a year, and it was not worth it, not at all.
This is Emily from Oklahoma City. I have $50,000 in student loan debt after completing a master's program immediately after a bachelor's. I'm still looking for a job, but I am proud of myself for continuing my education. In the end, I hope the debt will be worth it, but frankly, I'm not sure it is yet.
Those are your voices talking about your student loan debt, and we've been asking you, was it worth it? We got this from Hawaii. Yes, I promised my kids a college education. It has served them both in ways too numerous to quantify, but we'll be paying for the rest of our lives as we're in our late 60s with $110,000 in college debt. Tell us your student loan stories at 8778MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com. TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And on Tuesday, a cyber attack that first appeared in Ukraine quickly spread across Russia and Europe. There were a few networks affected here in the U.S., but Ukrainian officials called the attack unprecedented in its scale. The ransomware shut down computers at some of the world's biggest companies, including Russia's biggest oil company, even prompting their Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine to switch to manual radiation monitoring. Infected computers displayed a familiar message now to many users that the files on the computer have been encrypted and can't be uncovered unless the victim pays a $300 ransom in Bitcoin. Now, this attack appears to contain code from an NSA hacking tool that was stolen, leaked, and then used in the WannaCry ransomware attack that infected computers in more than 100 countries just this past May. Siobhan Gorman has more. She's director at the Brunswick Group. That's an advisory firm where she specializes in cybersecurity and privacy.
It seems to have originated from the same set of NSA tools that unleashed the WannaCry virus a month or so ago. You know, I think what we're seeing is just an amped up version of that virus that is now circulating. It looks like, whatever hacking group purloined this strain of it basically took it and added some additional components that makes it that much harder to stop.
What does the virus do?
Well, it basically locks down, it encrypts, in some cases, entire hard drives on computers, and basically says you need to pay us $300 or the equivalent of $300 in Bitcoin if you want to have access to your machines. And if they lock down certain types of machines, say in hospitals, all of a sudden you have procedures that can't go ahead.
Is the attacker's motivation known here? Is it for sure that this is just ransom for money, or is there any concern that this could be an attack or even a dry run by some state or non-state political actor here?
Well, there are certainly concerns about it. And the interesting thing about frankly, the shadow brokers' tools, which was essentially a cache of NSA cyber weapons that was stolen from NSA probably around last summer or so, is that people thought that the shadow brokers group that apparently stole these tools might be connected to, you know, Russia or the Russian government or hackers in Russia. It hasn't been proven, and the FBI, as far as I know, is still looking into where, you know, how that happened in the first place. But what happened was these tools were then unleashed publicly a few months ago by the shadow brokers. And so now they are available to anybody who wants to pick them up and adapt them for their use. And so there was a theory, and I don't know that it's actually been proven, that the WannaCry virus was unleashed by North Korea. So there's been a lot of speculation about state involvement with these tools, which obviously had an origin with a state as well, the U.S. government.
You know, Siobhan Gorman, maybe the strangest part about this story is the fact that some of this malicious code does come from the National Security Agency, our own NSA. And a lot of analysts like you were very critical after WannaCry and even last summer about the NSA's reaction to this theft, how they handled it, and how they advised the public. Does that criticism continue now? And what has the NSA done?
Well, what the NSA did was wait quite a few months after the tools were stolen to let Microsoft know that NSA had identified a vulnerability that could be exploited in a pretty significant way to get into, corporate computer systems or, you know, possibly government computer systems and others. And I think that what hopefully we will see out of the unleashing of these viruses is a little bit more of a debate about how NSA stockpiles these types of attacks without letting companies know that there's a major vulnerability that in order to protect their customers, they should really patch. These are called zero-day vulnerabilities. And in fact, there was a panel that studied potential NSA reforms in the wake of the Edward Snowden disclosure. And that panel actually recommended that NSA stop stockpiling these zero days. That was something that NSA fought very, very hard and won on. So they still have this ability, but it's I think, an important thing for us to really think about as a matter of U.S. policy.
And you mentioned Microsoft. I mean, WannaCry attacked Microsoft computers because of this vulnerability in Windows. They released a giant security patch that everybody was supposed to download. A few weeks later, a new ransomware attack. Are users who use Microsoft and Windows who downloaded the patch, are they protected now?
They are protected more. However, there are some additional bells and whistles that were attached to this latest version that we saw emerge yesterday. And so it steals the credentials that you can use to log on as well. So even if you have the patch, it does have some ability to break into your computer anyhow and lock it down.
Are individual users at risk here, or is this mostly an institutional attack?
Well, it depends on how individual users basically patch their equipment. I think that what we're hearing about are the corporate ones, but there's no reason why it wouldn't affect some individual users if their computer systems weren't patched. Usually Windows will now push out these patches to individual users. So if people have that automated patching capability enabled on their computer, then it will happen. But certainly there's no reason why anybody who's not using these Microsoft products wouldn't be at risk if they didn't use the patch.
Siobhan Gorman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Siobhan Gorman specializes in cybersecurity and privacy at the Brunswick Group.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting the original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. When a celebrity sex tape is leaked, a high-stakes legal battle between Gawker and former professional wrestler Hulk Hogan leads to the gossip site's ruin. Nobody Speak explores the shadowed world of billionaires manipulating free speech, ultimately revealing what power and money can do in undermining democracy. Now streaming only on Netflix.
In Chicago, back in 2014, 17-year-old Laquan McDonald was shot by police officer Jason Van Dyke. Video footage from a police cruiser dash cam showed the officer shooting McDonald 16 times in about 15 seconds as McDonald fell to the ground with a knife in his hand. The fallout from the case led to protests, investigations, and the resignation of the police superintendent in Chicago and first-degree murder charges for that officer. Van Dyke is now awaiting trial, but meanwhile, three other Chicago cops were indicted on Tuesday. They're charged with conspiring to cover up any alleged wrongdoing by filing false police reports. Sheila Betty was among the coalition of people who filed a petition to appoint a special prosecutor in this case. She's professor at the Northwestern School of Law and an attorney with the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center.
After Laquan McDonald was shot and killed, all of the officers who were on the scene, there were 10 officers in total, filed police reports. And those police reports were false. Those police reports talked about Laquan McDonald being threatening, being aggressive, being on the ground, still coming at Van Dyke after he was on the ground. Just a completely false narrative that was proven false by the video. And it's very clear that one of the reasons why those reports were filed was to try to cover up the actions of Jason Van Dyke. And this is not a new thing in the Chicago Police Department. The code of silence, the idea that officers will cover up for other officers when the law is broken, is something that is pervasive inside the department. So this is against the law. And so what happened here was the officers have been indicted, have been charged with conspiracy, with obstruction of justice, and official misconduct. These are only three of the 10 officers who were at the scene. We're still waiting to see what will happen with the other officers.
So clearly their police reports and their statements about what happened that night were contradicted by the dash cam video that we've all seen now. These officers must not have known that the shooting was being recorded when they filed these reports.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. I mean, these officers knew that this was being recorded. These officers knew that the culture of the Chicago Police Department would protect them from giving false statements. I think what these officers didn't know was that the video was going to become public. They knew this was being recorded.
So that seems like it may have been the difference here then, right? The video becoming public and then an outcry in the public after the video was viewed. And then, of course, the campaigns, which you were part of, to have a special prosecutor here.
That's exactly right. I mean, and one of the things that this really demonstrates is the importance of transparency with police departments across the country, including, of course, Chicago. Had the Laquan McDonald video not been released to the public, there's no question that many of the things that have happened here in Chicago around policing would not have happened in terms of the Department of Justice investigation and in terms of the Police Accountability Task Force. But also the crimes that these police officers appear to have committed would have remained unknown to the broader public. And the thing about the Laquan McDonald video is that it is an incredibly tragic case. But there are many other such cases that have not been brought to the public's attention.
So, Sheila Betty, we should stress that you're an advocate in this case. You advocated for that special prosecutor. You're not a lawyer in this case or a journalist. But from where you sit, do you believe that this is a case now, after Laquan McDonald's death, that is headed for accountability, both for Jason Van Dyke, the alleged shooter, and for these three officers who allegedly filed false reports?
So I was a part of the legal team that filed the petition for the special prosecutor, and I think it is an important thing that the system works as it should when police officers break the law. But I also think that the criminal justice system is not equipped to take on the systemic deficiencies in the Chicago Police Department. So while having these officers indicted, having the criminal justice process work, is an important thing for the family of Laquan McDonald and an important thing for them to get closure and justice, I think that it is not going to be the answer that is going to root out the systemic deficiencies, the racism, the violence that have infected the Chicago Police Department.
Sheila Betty, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sheila Betty is professor at the Northwestern School of Law.
No, et vous serez.
I won't resign. I repeat, I won't resign. I know what I did, and I know my actions were right. I demand a full and quick investigation to clear up the situation for the Brazilian people.
It's only been about a year since Brazil's president was impeached and thrown out of office, and now the new president is possibly facing criminal charges for corruption. Michel Temer on Monday became the first sitting president in almost three decades in Brazil to face criminal charges. This is a complicated story. It involves late-night rendezvous with meatpacking tycoons, millions of dollars in potential bribes, and a senior aide who was arrested. President Temer has been accused of taking bribes, and he may be tried in court if a two-thirds supermajority of the Brazilian Congress says he should. He could then be suspended and put on trial. Dom Phillips is a reporter for The New York Times and The Guardian. He's been covering Brazilian politics from Rio. Welcome, Dom.
Hi.
What's the basis of these charges against the president?
This latest political crisis exploded really in May when it was revealed that a meat tycoon called Joesley Batista had a meeting with the president late at night at the president's official residence, which wasn't on the agenda, and he secretly recorded this meeting. He was being investigated, and that has exploded. Joesley Batista said he was making payments to the former speaker of the lower house, who is jailed at the moment, who's from the same party as Michel Temer. And Temer said, you have to keep that up. Temer also indicated, he also said, who should this Batista, the executive said, who should I talk to when I have problems with the government? The president indicated a close aide and another lawmaker called Rodrigo Rocha Lores. This Lores guy then met another executive from the company, agreed to intervene in a dispute it was having, and was filmed accepting a suitcase with about $150,000. What the prosecutors are alleging is that this money was also destined for Michel Temer. So they've accused him of what's called passive corruption. Lores, the lawmaker, is in jail, and the president is vociferously defending himself against this. But the crisis is getting worse.
Yes. Is this an open and shut case against Temer? He's defending himself. What does he say?
He says, firstly, that he's been in politics a long time. He's been in the Congress a long time. He's a little bit too informal. He received the guy. He was humoring him. He never was involved with the money. They can't prove he accepted the money. Temer's basically saying it's a piece of fiction. He didn't do it.
How important is politics here, Dom Phillips? The Brazilian Congress is going to vote on whether or not the president can be tried as a potential criminal. His popularity must play into it here, and their political capital must play into it.
The president is the most unpopular president in at least 30 years. A poll at the weekend had his approval rating at just 7%. It's worth remembering that he was the vice president to Dilma Rousseff, who's a president who was impeached last year. He acted quite heavily in the whole political process of getting her impeached, and his party, he took over, and he's now even more unpopular than she was. An interesting number, which is in this opinion poll at the weekend, I think 76% of Brazilians wanted him to resign, but also 47% of Brazilians feel ashamed to be Brazilian as a result of these ongoing corruption scandals. So there's a lot of different factors. There's the economy, which now its very slight recovery seems to be almost slowing as a result of the latest political crisis. But his popularity in Congress, and there are about 30 parties in Congress, many of whom are in his coalition, and how long he can hang on to those. And there's also the actual allegations themselves.
Dom Phillips with The New York Times and The Guardian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
From the front porch to the backyard, tragedy in between. It's a new year, it's a new song, it's the same mystery.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Singer Drew Holcomb makes music about change, and he's done so in a steady stream of records since 2005. A lot has changed since Drew last visited The Takeaway a few years back, including politics. Holcomb is the lead vocalist and guitarist for Drew Holcomb and The Neighbors. It's a group of Tennesseans cobbled together from Memphis and East Nashville. Their latest album, called Souvenir, is personal in many ways. There are songs about addiction and memory, but Holcomb also wades into politics and the realities of a family divided in the age of President Trump. Drew Holcomb sat down with John Hockenberry to talk about his latest record, and he says he often finds himself completely avoiding the news and politics, and at other times, immersing himself in it.
I go from like intense engagement to complete escapism, sometimes within the course of the same day.
Complete escapism.
Yeah.
What is that for you?
Oh, for me, it's my daughter calls it, first off, the no phone zone. And so she says, Dad, this is a no phone zone.
On the other side, you go from total escapism to engagement. What kind of engagement?
Well, for me, it's like reading and reading and reading and trying to, follow the guys you really like to follow. For me, it's like, you know, David Fahrenthold from The Post. He's always got some good stuff going. And if you want to sort of get the sarcastic point of view, Matthew Iglesias over at Vox. And
then, yeah.
You know, but then I also like to follow. I've become friends with a U.S. senator from Nebraska named Ben Sasse.
Really?
Who's he's like a never-Trump Republican, so he's an interesting guy. He's very thoughtful, and he's a fan of my music, reached out, and so I enjoy his Twitter feed. And
so you have potential influence on a senator?
Well, maybe. I did send him an email after the election, and I said, the Republic is in your hands. Please, you know. Very like it was very Star Wars-esque sort of melodrama in my email.
And his response?
Let's talk about it next time we're together. Literally, that's what he said.
Oh, wow.
Got a rowdy heart and a broken wing. I've tried just about everything.
So, last album, very personal.
Yeah.
How about this one?
Yeah, this one's personal in a different sort of way. It's I wrote a lot of these songs with my bandmates, and so it's personal, but it's a little bit more sort of shared and cooperative. I mean, there's a lot of songs I wrote myself. I wrote New Year, Wild World, Rowdy Heart. Rowdy Heart's a really personal song. It's about probably one of my dearest friends in the world and their battle with overcoming addiction.
Going some way I've never been. Got a rowdy heart.
I wrote it at midnight in Amsterdam at a hotel looking out over the airport, so it sort of had a big picture sense to it when I wrote it.
You got your mama's sunshine, you got your daddy's rain, you're like a piece of heaven in a hurricane, and it's bubbling over.
Yeah, and then there's like a really fun song about my daughter called Mama's Sunshine, Daddy's Rain, which is like, it's just a song about a four-year-old girl and how much she means to me.
All day long, right or wrong, you question everything. Why the grass is green, can I stay up late, and why do bluebirds sing? Sometimes you cry your big blue eyes for no discernible reason. Your point of view, it comes and goes like the changing of the seasons. You got your mama's sunshine, you got your daddy's rain.
She runs the gamut, you know?
It's a great age.
It's a great age.
Yeah.
She is a blast.
Really is. Yeah. The song called Postcard Memories.
Yeah. That's probably my favorite.
Heard you pass south of Baltimore, wondering if you watch the ships rolling. Will you stay up till the dawn's early light? Do you ever wonder how I've been?
And, it sounds like somebody from the road.
Yeah.
Right? So you're either sending memories back or collected of yourself, or
yeah, I think you're kind of it's a song sort of about chasing memories and chasing shared memories that the other person's no longer there, you know, and you're kind of longing nostalgically for their participation in that search and that journey. And I think there's certain relationships that like they, you know, you give each other a piece of yourselves, and then that it's always the person's always a part of your life. It's a vague, you know, sort of narrative about that, but there's enough sort of particulars that I feel like it's weighted with a story, you know. And my favorite line of that song is, You know, I thought I saw you out there dancing on the ocean. Thought I heard you singing to Ralu Ralai. It's just this sort of like image of looking out at the endless sea, you know, and imagining that the person that's gone is out there somewhere. It's like you know, it's kind of like the adult version of Fievel singing Somewhere Out There.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which always haunted me as a kid, you know.
You're a politically engaged person. What do you think of what's going on?
The only word I can sort of use to describe the way I feel is just sort of bizarre. All traditional sort of political divides have been thrown out the window instead to sort of watch this sort of, you know, sort of circus go down. I think, you know, my dad and I do not see eye to eye politically. He is a very conservative guy, and I'm not, and we had these conversations before the election, and my dad said, you know, there's no way I'm voting for this guy, even though he's voted Republican since he turned probably 18 years old. You know, he just said, this guy doesn't stand for anything that I've taught you, you know, so don't worry about me. I'm not going to vote for him. You know, he doesn't treat women with respect. We had a handicapped brother. So that sort of ticked my sense of self, you know, ticked me off pretty bad and ticked off my family. But just the general sense of like other people matter. And it's like this bulldozer of a personality drives straight through the middle of all of our sensibilities. And I think we're just going to continue to watch it self-implode. You know, this idea of like destroying all the status quo just for the sake of it is sort of I don't know. I just don't understand the point of view of that massive amount of disruption for disruption's sake.
Walking through my neighborhood, I have nothing left to say. Life and death, they never rest, and I've still got bills to pay. On earth as it is in heaven, it don't make sense to me. It's a new year, it's a new song, it's the same mystery.
It's a Drew Holcomb, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
It's the same.
Drew Holcomb, his new album, Souvenir, is available now.
As he bent down, the Browns caught sight of a label round his neck. It said, please look after this bear, thank you.
Well, we leave you with a bit of sad news today for Paddington Bear fans. Author Michael Bond, creator of the beloved children's character, has died at the age of 91.
Paddington's been around for a good many years now, so he's really an integral part of the family, and I suppose that makes me his virtual father.
Paddington first ambled on the scene in 1958 in A Bear Called Paddington. He's been having adventures in gorging on marmalade ever since. We will look after that bear, Michael. We promise. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
RI, Public Radio International.